Welcome back. We have finally looped back around, so to speak, and there's at least one listener who will be very pleased, though I forget who exactly commented asking for today's subject. But today we have the inspiration behind Truman Capote's game International Daisy Chain, that furious lesbian, our gateway to Hollywood, Mercedes DaCosta.
So if she's inspiring a game like that, we have to assume that she's going to be rivaling the great Natalie Barney.
I would think so, but she made quite the striking figure. Mercedes was notorious for walking the streets of New York in pants, pointed shoes with buckles, a tricorn hat, and a cape. Her slicked back hair, red lips, and chalk-white face prompted actress Tallulah Bankhead to call her Countess Dracula. Others said things like, "Say what you will about Mercedes, she's had the most important women of the 20th century." But that's in the future. Our story begins in 1893 when she arrives as the last of her parents' 8 children, so 3 older brothers and 4 older sisters. The family, of which her father was Cuban and her mother Spanish, was already living in New York by then. And in fact, her parents may well have attended the famous Vanderbilt Gilded Age Ball in 1883. If you've watched the first season of the show Gilded Age, the ending ball is based off of this event to give you an idea of what that was like. So we're starting this episode in the upper echelons of society at the end of the Gilded Age.
So this is not a starving artist here.
No, this is not. This is a rich girl. Mercedes was partly taken care of by an Irish maid, who would take her to Catholic Mass where she made faces at people and sat next to the orphans of the local Catholic orphanage. This led to the misconception of one man who thought her an orphan and wanted to adopt her. That didn't happen, but the man turned out to be the music theater producer, Augustin Daly, who introduced her to the world of theater by taking her each Sunday afternoon to the apartment of an actress friend to reenact plays and play with miniature theater dollhouses. This started Mercedes' lifelong love of theater. When she was a little older, she'd sneak away to see performances, one of which was Maud Adams as Peter Pan. When she was 14, Mercedes' father unfortunately died by suicide in 1907 in a rustic luxury camp owned by J.P. Morgan. It is speculated that this was partly in response to the U.S. economic downturn of 1906, which led to a market crash in 1907 and a run on the banks. Her father wasn't known for frugality, so he may have panicked when he saw his savings dwindle. He hadn't really ever worked either. He'd just invested in a sugar business and a steamship line. After the funeral, the family went to Europe, where Mercedes' sister, Rita, lived in France after a second marriage. The first ended in divorce. Naturally, the remaining teenagers ended up at boarding school in France, but not Les Rouges, the school Natalie Barney attended. However, like Natalie's French boarding school experience, there were love letters between the girls and crushes galore. The ability to afford this school, though, did not mean that all was well financially. The family had to sell their extra houses and reduce the number of servants to cut down costs.
Oh no, not selling their extra houses.
Speaking of Natalie, Mercedes' sister Rita frequented several salons, including hers and Gertrude Stein's. It's likely Mercedes tagged along sometimes, and certainly attended her sister's own artistic gatherings. If you can't already tell, her sister had quite the impact on her life, despite an 18-year age gap.
Wait, does Rita know that Mercedes likes women? Because it seems like she's running in these very sapphic circles.
Rita was certainly aware of the sapphic tendencies of the women in her circles. As to whether or not she was aware about her sisters, I think she probably had a clue. I don't know if they actually discussed things, if Mercedes ever confided in Rita. If they were as close as they seemed to be, I can imagine Mercedes did, especially considering the company that Rita kept.
Yeah, I love the idea that she had that connection, that she was able to, you know, be real with a relative during those times.
By now, we've hit 1914. War erupts in Europe and everyone gets back to New York. The war doesn't affect Mercedes as much. Instead, she gets help from a friend of Rita's, Bessie Marbury, a theater producer, in the form of Marbury playing matchmaker for the now 20-something Mercedes. This led to her affair with the actress Alla Nazimova, who was still a stage actress at the time and a very successful one. Despite Nazimova's very successful career, her managers worried about women always rushing to meet her after the shows. It worried them because they were trying to keep her bisexuality on the down low. In fact, they didn't care about it as long as her affairs were discreet. The image of her as a seductive, dangerous siren and the roles given to her were created to deflect from these affairs, actually. Mercedes' affair with Nazimova didn't last long, but it was to be only the beginning of her sapphic connections to other performers. She was soon having another affair with the dancer Isadora Duncan, which would last several years, but the more serious life development is that Mercedes took up playwriting. Her first attempt was a one-act play in 1916, set in the French countryside during the still-ongoing First World War. The plot is about a peasant woman who takes in a wounded German soldier, only to realize he had killed her husband and stolen his wedding ring. She kills him, and it ends on a very patriotic note of what one is willing to do for France. The play was never produced. This was followed by a full-length play set in England in 1911 and also created in 1916. It's another play that ends with murder, though the context is a son murders his divorced mother because he mistakes his father's gloves on her desk for some other man's and believes her to be promiscuous as claimed by the vicious rumors of 15 years before during her divorce. Despite some interest from producers, again, the play was never produced.
Ugh, can she not catch a break?
Despite all this, 27-year-old Mercedes married Abram Poole, a wealthy portrait painter, in 1920, because her mother would say things like, "I would die in peace if I knew you were happily married."
Oh yeah, that sounds like a great reason to get married.
They had met at a party when he got back from the war in France, but she turned down his first proposal. In the end, she did marry him as a sort of cover and to get her mother off her back. Naturally, the relationship was unconventional. It was rumored that she brought a girlfriend with her on the honeymoon. That same year, Mercedes published her first book about a teenager and later adult bisexual woman who grapples with the fact that both her crushes may be involved with each other. Since the book is dedicated to her mother, it's thought this was her way of letting her mother know that she was a lesbian. It is not recorded what her mother thought of this.
That's one way to do it.
But there were other developments in the form of Eva Le Gallien, the stage actress who previously appeared on this podcast.
One of my favorite developments.
3 days before Mercedes' marriage, they had lunch at the Ritz and talked of someday meeting the great Italian actress, Eleanor Dusa, who you can think of as the Italian version of the French Sarah Bernhardt.
Is Mercedes still with Isadora? What is going on here?
Mercedes isn't really with Isadora anymore, though that is not the end of the dancer's appearance in Mercedes' life. Much like Natalie Barney, Mercedes was not always monogamous.
Yeah, I mean, this is right before her marriage, too, and she's with Eva, so I'm getting that sense. But I guess it's different when she doesn't like men at all.
The news of Mercedes' marriage was still a sore spot at the time of the dinner, and a surprise to Eva, who did not see the point in such a thing for her lover. However, the marriage didn't end the affair. After the honeymoon, the two went on a social whirl. Mercedes would later write of this time, "I suppose it was the newly found excitement of homosexuality, which after the war was expressed openly in nightclubs and cabarets, and was like drinking forbidden, which made it all the more enticing. And then her mother died at the end of 1921. That fact didn't immediately end the marriage to Poole, but it also didn't stop Mercedes from having a fling with the actress known more commonly as Michael Strange, her pen name for her erotic poetry. If you want her actual name, it's Blanche.
Yeah, do we know anything about Mercedes grieving during this time, or was that kind of kept private?
It's not given as much light in biographies and accounts of her. I expect she had her ways of dealing with it, but we don't really know what.
All we know is that she threw herself into this strange affair, as one might say.
Yes, and it was rather strange. For instance, any disagreements between Strange and her husband, the actor John Barrymore, were not about Mercedes. Instead, imagine that meme of someone asking, why a threesome has to only be for sex? Why can't I get involved in a couple's argument if I want to?
Oh, sounds messy.
It was. Their personalities were a clash, which Mercedes herself pointed out to Strange before the wedding. But moving on, the affair with Eva continued and produced several play scripts. The productions were unsuccessful. A story of Mercedes' life by this point. When Eva went on tour afterwards with a more successful play written by someone else, Mercedes left for Europe with Abram, by which time she seems to have succeeded in meeting every woman who has popped up on this podcast, from Maude Adams to Marchesa Cassati, a phrase I never thought I'd say.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. Does she win our... Does she break the record now? Does she win her prize?
Sure, we can give her a virtual Beyond the Grave medal for linking so many disparate women. Anyway, Mercedes and Eva would reunite in Paris months later. They shared neighboring hotel rooms, and at a nightly whistle, Eva rushed from one room to the other. As one biographer noted, Abram was either very naive or incredibly open-minded, because there's no way he couldn't have noticed what was going on.
Yeah, that doesn't seem particularly subtle.
No one appears to have noted his reaction to the whole thing, but Eva was frequently jealous and threw fits over his presence. Despite this, Mercedes and Eva would hang out in Natalie Barney's salon and would finally meet Eleanor Dusa in a 1923 trip to Europe. They became friends to the point that when Dusa died on tour in the U.S. in 1924, it was the two of them who made arrangements for her body, which eventually was shipped back to Italy for burial, but only after a lying in state at a Catholic cathedral. By the mid-1920s, after another failed joint production, Eva and Mercedes broke up. It sounds like there was a brief depression after this, so Mercedes left for Europe again in 1926, where she had a renewed fling with Isadora Duncan.
Ah, she returns.
Just briefly before her neck gets broken by a scarf. However, this was only a brief diversion before more bad things happened back in New York. While driving without a license, as she claimed she'd only just taken the test and it hadn't been mailed to her yet, Mercedes accidentally banged into a cop with her car, but she didn't notice till he chased her down and arrested her. She ended up out on $500 bail, but a month later the court said she was fine and that the arrest should never have occurred. A decision that I can't see being made today.
Yeah, that is wild, was it? Because she was famous? Because they liked her a lot? Just her charming personality? Or was that just kind of how things were back then?
I get the feeling it's just kind of how things were back then, because she's not particularly famous at the time. Like, she's known
right, all of her plays aren't getting... I guess all of her plays aren't getting produced, so...
Yeah, like, only in certain circles is she known.
I guess she was also born into wealth. Do you think that might have been a factor, or...?
I can't really say, because even just looking through Gilded Age, turn of the century, about rich people books, you're not really going to see the name D'Acosta, just in the same way you wouldn't see Barney. It's like too out of the spotlight to really make history news. They're like footnotes.
Gotcha. So she's just not well known. This is just how it is.
There were also playwriting troubles. While another play was picked up and produced, Mercedes' producers changed the name suddenly without consulting her, never advertised that change, and then got sued by another writer as the name made him believe they were producing his work without paying him.
That's probably the worst decision they could have made then.
Probably it was, and then one of the few upsides came in the form of the Russian ballerina Tamara Karsavina, despite the latter's marriage.
Well, we all know that. I mean, that's a little marriage between friends.
But this appears to have been more of an on and off friends with benefits situation rather than a relationship. There were other bad times before the end of the 1920s. More failures with her plays, and her sister Rita died, which led to Mercedes drinking heavily during late-night kitchen meetups with people like the actresses Nazimova, Lorette Taylor, and Constance Collier.
So it sounds like this is a really rough time.
Yes, now it is this point in time when Bessie Marbury calls and says that RKO, a Hollywood production company, wants a script for a film starring the Polish actress Pola Negri. Marbury literally said something along the lines of, "I know you're depressed over your sister and life sucks, but Hollywood might be the change you need." So Mercedes left for California and started writing her first ever film script. This despite the recent 1930 motion picture production code going into effect, which banned depictions of interracial sex, abortion, incest, drug use, nudity, and homosexuality.
Among other fun things.
Yeah, the list was a lot longer, but those really stood out. Note, many of Mercedes' works up to this point involve homosexuality and bisexuality. However, at this time, it was still a good career move. Hollywood, even as it made the leap from silent films to talkies, was producing more films, while Broadway was producing fewer plays. In fact, as the U.S. hurtled into the Great Depression, the public still attended films. The same could not be said for stage theaters.
Ah, so she is making a jump off of a sinking ship.
So, Mercedes arrives in Hollywood and promptly gets invited to tea with the actress Salka Vertel in Santa Monica, where she meets Greta Garbo, who is very good friends with Vertel. Thus began a 30-year crush. There also quickly began an affair, and the shelving of the screenplay Mercedes was working on as the studio decided not to make the film.
Oh, come on. She moved all the way out there.
So, off Mercedes and Greta went to a cabin in the Sierra Nevada mountains for 3 weeks, though in her own writing, Mercedes would insist it was for six. She tended to have little inaccuracies, usually to do with how long things lasted and exact dates. Naturally, eventually, the press caught wind of this little trip. No one was amused, not Garbo, not Mercedes, and most definitely not the studio.
Yes, especially when the code has just been put into effect.
The gossip, including the descriptor, the most talked about woman in Hollywood, is the woman no wife fears. At least back then. Probably today there's quite a few wives who would fear Garbo. But anyway. It alarmed Garbo, who proceeded to spend Christmas alone in New York. Later, she would sail to Sweden without Mercedes, who then wrote, "After she left, Hollywood seemed empty to me." That didn't last long. Enter Marlene Dietrich, the counterpart of Garbo, as I like to think of her. Unlike Garbo, Dietrich didn't turn tail at any whispers. After all, this woman dressed in tuxedos and entered lesbian nightclubs in films. That said, Dietrich's habit of always giving gifts like scarves and other clothes was perturbing for Mercedes. She wasn't used to it all, and it unnerved her.
Oh no, my girlfriend's giving me gifts.
In the end, the relationship ended after a little over a year. Dietrich would sail for Germany for a time then, right as Garbo came back from Sweden, only to move in with Sauka Vertel and Sauka's husband, much to Mercedes' dismay. Now, in her autobiography, Mercedes claimed that she had been working on a script about Queen Christina of Sweden, which she now showed to Garbo. She goes on to grumble that the idea was stolen from her, as Garbo did portray Queen Christina in an early 1930s film, which, by the way, I gotta say is a great film. You should be able to find it on YouTube. Anyway, one biographer notes that in actuality, it was probably Sauka's idea that was brought to the studio head a few years before Garbo's trip to Sweden and back.
Yeah, because usually, I mean, I don't know about back then, but it takes a while to make a movie.
Back to our protagonist. Mercedes sulking is not helped by being flung 60 feet out of a car and landing on her head.
Yeah, ouch, that's worth more than sulking.
She thought she was dead. She wasn't. She just required several weeks in a hospital and plastic surgery, and somehow escaped permanent disfigurement. Then, in early 1935, her husband announced he wanted a divorce after 15 years.
What now?
I'm rather surprised it took him this long. Anyway, he planned to marry a dancer from the George White Scandal Show, a rival of the Ziegfeld Follies in New York. Mercedes was stunned. As she saw it, I was too European to feel, as Americans do, that the moment the sex relation is over, one must fly to the divorce courts. I reiterate, it was probably a white marriage, no sex, so I'm surprised it took a by all accounts straight man 15 years to leave.
I'm sure they had their reasons.
The divorce was quite fraught. As Abram related it, he'd walked into their bedroom one night to find Mercedes with another woman. While he supposedly knew of her inclinations, seeing it was another thing entirely. It immediately led to a row that ended with her smashing one of his antique chairs. He was also upset that she spent his money more than her own because she was only occasionally under contract with a studio. Usually, she was unemployed. The divorce was finalized in 1935, and Abram had to pay Mercedes the modern equivalent of about $5,000 a month.
So that'll teach her to use his money.
By that point, it'd taken a toll on her health as she'd lost weight. A dietitian recommended a vegetarian diet, which was easy to follow as she'd sometimes gotten sick and vomited if forced to eat meat as a child. Which sounds like a meat intolerance to me, by the way.
I love this irony of being put on a vegetarian diet to gain weight. That's not usually what people think of, but I'm so glad that she's finding something that she can actually eat.
From here followed a round of semi-religious, sort of philosophical wanderings and consultations with people like a nun and an Indian mystic. Mercedes asked all of these people for advice on her problems, including her love life, namely trying to get back together with Garbo. She was eventually counseled to write to Garbo asking about a visit to her in Sweden. The reply was cool, but still an invite. Mercedes went to Stockholm, and her mood improved vastly. She believed their relationship had been restored.
That's ominous wording.
It is indeed, as I'm sure you can already guess, that was not the case. In reality, this was just a brief interlude, similar to that time Natalie Barney and Renee Vivian got back together and went to Lesbos for a bit. Just like then, this relationship doesn't start up again. Sadly, Mercedes only found that out when she returned to Hollywood, got a house ready for Garbo to live in with her, only for Garbo to show up and move into a different house nearby. In the late 1930s, Mercedes turned more towards experimenting with Eastern religions and philosophies, to the point that she'd later say that although she had grown up Catholic, she would be, if she had to be anything, a Buddhist. When she returned from her travels in Asia, she again tried to reignite her relationship with Garbo. Again, this didn't happen.
Sounds like maybe a sign for her to chill out about Garbo.
As we will see later, there is quite possibly a medical reason behind this. But on the upside, Mercedes was reintroduced to the actress Anna Munson, and they had an affair. But that only lasted a few months. possibly partly due to Mercedes worrying that other women, including Marlena Dietrich and possibly Dorothy Osner, were trying to steal Munson away from her, though that second name is only a guess based off of a mention of a Dorothy A, and I only know of one woman in Hollywood at the time whose name fits.
Mysterious, but in any case, someone's trying to steal her girl.
So she thinks. And now we come to World War II. And the U.S. entering the war. In 1941, with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Mercedes applied for an editorial job at the newly created Office of War Information, which handled all media that sold the war, so to speak, for things like recruitment efforts. This led to a very lengthy FBI interview, which included asking about her sexuality. She then followed her deceased sister Rita's advice of handle any difficult situation with humor. So, Mercedes said she was ambidextrous and androgynous, a sort of combination of both.
I thought she was a lesbian?
She is.
Okay. That sounds very bi.
This is not like Bankhead saying I'm ambidextrous.
This is just her throwing around big words.
Pretty much. Because, you see, the man interviewing her was bewildered and demanded she spell those words out for the secretary. To which Mercedes replied, I'm afraid not. I am not here to give the government spelling lessons. Despite this, she got the job after that. Which,
you really could just, you could get jobs back then.
Yeah, after essentially insulting the interviewer too. But getting this job was a good thing, as she had no offers for writing in Hollywood by then. So she moved back to New York to work on the Victory Bulletin. She did not stay long. By 1943, she'd jumped ship to be the associate editor of the Tomorrow magazine, whose founder was interested in the scientific investigation of the paranormal.
This is a wild series of career shifts. I love it.
Quite the change. I get the feeling Mercedes was trying to figure out what to do with herself. The end of the war did not see an improvement. Her brother and brother-in-law died right before Victory in Europe. Garbo still didn't want to get back to her either. At this point, it seems like Mercedes is shooting herself in the foot with her love life, at least. By the way, though, Garbo does still write to her at times, so it's not like it's only Mercedes communicating here, just so you know.
So she's not being a complete creep here.
Not entirely, no. In fact, it's Garbo who asks for a meeting in the late 1940s. It is not a happy reunion. Afterwards, Garbo wrote she didn't want to see Mercedes again. This was not the way things went, though, as they had mutual friends who would invite them both to brunches and such, and they would both go knowing the other would be there. At this point, it's just complicated, and will continue to be so, as Garbo will still write encouraging letters at some points in the future.
Mixed messages there.
But moving on from the confusion of the Swedish Sphinx, Mercedes continues with her writing into the 1950s. Productions still don't materialize, though. She also has a reoccurrence of an old eye infection, which isn't very surprising. She is in her early 60s, so health problems are expected to start to crop up. The eye trouble forced her to wear an eye patch, which, combined with her cape and tricorn hat, made her look like a pirate.
Okay, hot.
Several friends, including former lovers like the dancer Karsavina, worried and offered help, but Mercedes liked being in control of her life, that feeling of not being helpless, and that was taken to a level where she just didn't accept help. This situation was not helped by what some analysts would call her erotomania over Garbo, which is basically a delusion that one is loved by another and concerns idealized love with someone of higher social status usually, and with the average age of the disorder's onset being between 40 and 55. Kinda sounds like what happens between fans and influencers today. Side note, Mercedes was 39 when she met Garbo, so roughly about the age for this onset.
Is this like an actual thing? This sounds kind of like a parasocial relationship, although that's more like with influencers and fans. But also, she does know Garbo. Like, I don't know. This sounds like something that should be more thoroughly investigated. Because, like, erotomania, it just sounds like one of those, like, Freudian things that people come up with in the, like, 20th century.
According to the National Institutes of Health, it is a relatively rare condition, and while the incidence is unknown, the lifetime prevalence of delusional disorder is 0.2%.
Interesting. So it might be a thing. But then, you know, being gay was also considered a disorder for some time. I'm just saying, it sounds like a real thing that she experienced, but I'm not convinced that it's a particular delusion so much like a particular kind of, you know what I'm saying? It just sounds like a thing that happened to her in particular, because life was not doing well for her, and she had had this relationship that seemed to be really good when it was good, and she just seems to have kind of clung to it, even despite the fact that she was getting breadcrumbs from Garbo.
So you mean like she never got over her ex?
Yeah.
Could be. But anyway, there's all of that causing problems, but Mercedes tries to pull herself out of a rut by writing her autobiography, Here Lies the Heart, which appeared in 1960. Marlena Dietrich liked it, though she noted that Mercedes should have talked about her sister Rita more. Garbo was not amused, as she was practically a hermit in New York City by then and didn't like any attention. Eva Le Gallien was furious. The angry reactions came from the possibility of being outed, even though Mercedes never mentioned sexual orientation and stuff like that. It was the whole, these are my friends routine. But people who use their brains could probably read between the lines. The book was not enough to keep her afloat financially, as the divorce alimony from Abram Poole ran out with his death in 1961. Mercedes did manage to keep an apartment until her death in May 1968 at age 75. The only person at her bedside was her sister Maria. She was cremated and her ashes were placed in a cemetery vault alongside her mother's and her sister Rita's. Despite the early promise she'd shown as a poet, novelist, and playwright between 1919 and 1928, her writing career never ignited. Instead, she's known as a social butterfly, and for all her more accomplished, well-remembered lovers. As Cecil Beaton, friend and costume designer, said upon hearing of her death, I cannot be sorry at her death. I am only sorry that she should have been so unfulfilled as a character. Or, as Mercedes herself said at the end of her autobiography, some things are never to be more than dreamed. Thank you for listening. Subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter. There's the occasional YouTube poll post thing now. And remember, when someone asks you, Garbo or Dietrich, be like Mercedes and say, why not both?